Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want. And we should have the right of determination of what we want to do in terms of our gun laws in our state.
In a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court strikes down a century-old New York law that limited the carrying of concealed handguns outside the home. Five other states have similar laws that are now in jeopardy. California, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. We'll get an update from Slate writer Mark Joseph Stern, who says Clarence Thomas's maximalist Second Amendment ruling is a nightmare for gun control. Then the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol reveals new details about Donald Trump's efforts to pressure the Justice Department to subvert the election.
I want to make sure we don't gloss this over.
Just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to us. The president wanted the top Justice Department officials to declare that the election was corrupt, even though, as he knew, there was absolutely no evidence to support that statement.
Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger led the questioning of former top Justice Department officials like Trump's former acting Deputy Attorney General, Richard Donahue.
I said, Mr. President, within 24, 48, 72 hours, you could have hundreds and hundreds of resignations of the leadership of your entire Justice Department because of your actions. What's that going to say about you?
We'll bring you the explosive highlights from the hearing. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Senate's approved a bipartisan gun safety bill by a vote of 65 to 33. The vote comes just weeks after the mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas, that killed more than 30 people altogether. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer praised the bill.
This is not a cure-all for all the ways gun violence affects our nation. But it is a long overdue step in the right direction. Passing this gun safety bill is truly significant, and it's going to save lives.
Measures in the bill include expanded background checks for individuals under the age of 21 and financial incentives for states to pass red flag laws. The Senate bill, however, does not include a number of gun control initiatives that were included in a recent bill approved by House Democrats, which aimed to ban the sale of large capacity magazines and raise the minimum age to purchase an assault weapon from 18 to 21. In both the Buffalo and Uvalde massacres, the gunman was 18 years old. The Senate vote came just hours after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a New York law that limited the carrying of concealed handguns outside the home. The court's ruling was 6-3. Five other states have similar laws that are now in jeopardy: California, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. In the majority opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the Second Amendment, quote, protects an individual's right to carry a handgun for self-defense outside the home, unquote. The ruling is seen as a major setback for gun control efforts. In his dissent, retiring Justice Stephen Breyer blasted the majority opinion, writing that will make it harder for states to address the dangers of gun violence. We'll have more on the ruling after headlines. The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has revealed Donald Trump heavily pressured the Justice Department to help him overturn the 2020 election. At a hearing Thursday, former top DOJ officials said Trump urged the department to seize voting machines, declare the election results corrupt, and investigate bizarre conspiracy theories. During Thursday's hearing, video was aired of former Attorney General William Barr suggesting Trump came very close to staying in power.
If the position of the department was, we're not even looking at this until after Biden's in office, I'm not sure we would have had a transition at all.
During Thursday's hearing, former acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue was questioned by Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger about Trump's efforts to pressure acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen.
You also noted that Mr. Rosen said to Mr. Trump, quote, DOJ can't and won't snap its fingers and change the outcome of the election. How did the president respond to that, sir?
He responded very quickly and said, essentially, that's not what I'm asking you to do. What I'm just asking you to do is just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman.
Many of Trump's efforts to push the Department of Justice involved a lower-level DOJ environmental attorney named Jeffrey Clark, who Trump considered naming attorney general. On Wednesday morning, the FBI raided Clark's home. Meanwhile, the January 6th committee revealed six members of Congress who supported Trump's coup attempt sought presidential pardons. Mo Brooks of Alabama, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gohmert of Texas, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, and Andy Biggs of Arizona. We'll have more on the January 6th hearing later in the program. Ukrainian officials have ordered troops to withdraw from the besieged eastern city of Severodonetsk, which has been the site of weeks of heavy fighting. The move brings Russia closer to seizing all the Luhansk region. This comes as the United States has announced it'll send an additional $450 million in military aid to Ukraine, including medium-range rocket systems. On Thursday, the European Union voted to grant candidate status to Ukraine and Moldova, beginning a process for the countries to join the EU. On Thursday, China hosted a virtual meeting with the leaders of Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, a group known collectively as BRICS. Chinese President Xi Jinping opened the meeting by saying nations need to reject, quote, Cold War mentality. He called for opposition to unilateral sanctions in a reference to efforts by the United States and its allies to isolate Russia after it invaded Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin also addressed the virtual summit.
The countries of our alliance, BRICS, are intensifying their cooperation on a whole range of issues of international and regional agendas. BRICS countries' authority and global influence are growing with every year. It's an objective process because the BRICS five are well known for having enormous political, economic, scientific, and social potential. We have all the opportunities to work together effectively and to develop global stability and security, sustainable growth, prosperity, and improvements to the well-being of the population.
Afghan officials say the death toll from Wednesday's earthquake has risen to at least 1,150. Over 10,000 homes were destroyed or damaged in the largest earthquake to hit Afghanistan in over 20 years. At least five more people died earlier today in a strong aftershock. Many Afghans lost multiple relatives in the quake.
The quake happened at night. I was not here myself, but my brothers were here. That's my brother, that one. They were here. The quake suddenly happened at night. Our houses were destroyed. 12 people of our family were martyred. Two of the injured were my brothers.
The International Red Cross is calling on nations to release Afghanistan's foreign exchange reserves in the wake of the earthquake. Last year, the United States froze nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank following the takeover by the Taliban. The United Nations Human Rights Office has blamed Israeli forces for fatally shooting Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh last month as she covered an Israeli military raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Earlier today, a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office said, quote, all information we have gathered is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague, Ali Samoudi, came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians. in Ecuador. Indigenous protesters tried to storm the National Assembly in the capital, Quito, on Thursday, on the 11th day of the demonstrations against right-wing President Guillermo Lasso's economic policies and rising fuel prices. At least four protesters have been killed so far and nearly 100 injured. The protests have been led by the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, or CONAI. This is the group's leader, Leonidas Iza.
The House of Culture has been taken by force by the people. It's the first triumph, brothers and sisters. Second, what the national government is saying at this moment, it's simply in their hands. We are not going to lose the North. I have been detained. They have tried to assassinate me. Yet we are alive and we have said, here are the 10 points and period. And if for that reason the government falls, it is not our problem, brothers and sisters.
The Burmese military has moved the country's deposed leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, to solitary confinement. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate has been jailed since a military coup in February of 2021. The U.S. Supreme Court's ruled individuals cannot sue police officers who do not read them their Miranda rights at the time of their arrest. The ruling was 6-3, with all six conservative justices in the majority. The ACLU criticized the ruling, saying, quote, this dangerous decision widens the gap between what the Constitution guarantees and what we can hold our government accountable for. We'll have more on this later in the show. In other legal news, California lawmakers have approved a bill to protect abortion providers and patients from civil suits in other states. California Assembly member Rebecca Bauer Cahan said the legislation is aimed at making California a, quote, legal sanctuary for reproductive choice. The vote comes as the nation prepares for the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a ruling in which it's expected to overturn Roe v. Wade. Thursday marked the 50th anniversary of Title IX, a 1972 federal law barring discrimination on the basis of sex in any school that accepts federal funding. The Biden administration marked the anniversary by proposing to expand protections under Title IX to transgender students. The National Women's Law Center praised the move, but called on the White House to protect trans student athletes as well. And the University of Washington Center for Human Rights has revealed a private plane owned by the New England Patriots football team has been used at least three times this month by the federal government for deportation flights to Honduras. The finding comes as part of a broader probe by the center looking at how professional and college sports teams charter many of the same planes used on deportation flights. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's been 1 month since the May 24th massacre at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, when an 18-year-old gunman killed 19 fourth graders and two teachers. Just 10 days before, a white supremacist 18-year-old wearing body armor, carrying an assault rifle, opened fire on a supermarket in the heart of Buffalo, New York's African-American community, killing 10 people. Of the 13 shoppers and store workers shot in the assault, 11 were black. In response, thousands of people took to the streets across the country to continue to demand the Biden administration enact federal gun control laws. Well, on Thursday, the U.S. Senate approved a bipartisan gun safety bill by a vote of 65-33. It's the first time in decades the Senate agreed to new gun legislation. This is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
This is not a cure-all for all the ways gun violence affects our nation, but it is a long overdue step in the right direction. Passing this gun safety bill is truly significant. And it's going to save lives.
Measures in the bill include expanded background checks for people under the age of 21 and financial incentives for states to pass red flag laws. The Senate bill, however, does not include a number of gun control initiatives that were included in a recent bill approved by House Democrats, which aimed to ban the sale of large capacity magazines and raise the minimum age to purchase an assault weapon from 18 to 21. The Buffalo and Uvalde gunmen were both 18 years old. The Democratic-led House is expected to take up the bill today to send to President Biden's desk. The Senate's vote came just hours after the Supreme Court struck down a century-old New York law that limited the carrying of concealed handguns outside the home. The court's ruling, 6-3. Five other states have similar laws that are now in jeopardy: California, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. In the majority opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the Second Amendment, quote, protects an individual's right to carry a handgun for self-defense outside the home. The ruling is seen as a major setback for gun control efforts following the recent mass shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde. New York Governor Kathy Hochul blasted the ruling.
This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want. And we should have the right of determination of what we want to do in terms of our gun laws in our state.
Retiring Justice Stephen Breyer wrote in his dissent, quote, many states have tried to address some of the dangers of gun violence just described by passing laws that limit in various ways who may purchase, carry, or use firearms of different kinds. The court today severely burdens states' efforts to do so, unquote. Meanwhile, Supreme Court lawyer and former U.S. Acting Solicitor General Neil Katyal tweeted, going to be very weird if Supreme Court ends a constitutional right to obtain an abortion next week, saying it should be left to the states to decide, right after it just imposed a constitutional right to concealed carry of firearms, saying it cannot be left to the states to decide. Well, for more, we're joined in New York by Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer at Slate, covering the U.S. Supreme Court, federal appellate, district, state, and local courts. His latest piece is headlined, Clarence Thomas's Maximalist Second Amendment Ruling is a Nightmare for Gun Control. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark. So can you just lay out this ruling for us?
Yes. So Justice Clarence Thomas's opinion for the court really works a revolution in Second Amendment law. It declares that any restriction on the right to self-defense is presumptively unconstitutional, and that the only way a state can save its gun restriction is if it can pinpoint some historical analog that not only existed, but was common in either 1791 when the Second Amendment was ratified, or 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified, applying the Second Amendment to the states. Of course, those were very different times from today. To give one example, there were not subways back then. And so when states look to, say, limit the carrying of guns on subways, they will now be severely burdened, if not totally disarmed, so to speak, because they cannot look back to history to satisfy Thomas's new and very stringent test.
So explain where what the maximalist stance of Clarence Thomas is.
So Justice Thomas writes that the Second Amendment is different from other rights in that the courts cannot look at the real-world impact of gun violence when assessing the legality of gun restrictions. This is very different from every other right. When we look at free speech, the right against unreasonable searches, the court always balances interests. It asks whether the government has a compelling interest, whether it has tailored its restriction to further that interest, and it looks at how the government's actions have actually addressed the problem that it seeks to solve. In this decision, Clarence Thomas says all of that is off the table in Second Amendment cases. Judges are simply prohibited from considering any kind of empirical evidence about how gun restrictions or gun laws have an effect on the real world, including whether certain gun laws happen to protect our communities and individuals from gun violence. He says that's irrelevant to the Constitution. It doesn't matter if these laws save lives or not. All that matters is whether a state can prove that the framers of the Second or 14th Amendment would have greenlighted that law. And if you can't kind of hold a seance with those framers and prove to Clarence Thomas's satisfaction that they would have been okay with what you're trying to do, then your gun law will be struck down by the federal judiciary.
Talk about what the New York law, the century-old New York law, was.
So the New York law restricted who could carry a concealed weapon in public places and held that in order to get such a permit, you had to show some kind of heightened need for self-defense. You couldn't just say, I'm scared of other people and want to be able to shoot them if they attack me. You had to show that, for instance, you had a stalker, you were a victim of abuse. And that's very similar to other states' laws like California, like Maryland, near where I live. But in this decision, Clarence Thomas said, well, those laws are historical anomalies. And in fact, for much of American history, individuals have had a guaranteed right to carry firearms in public that the government cannot take away without a very good, compelling reason. To support that argument, he cherry-picked a lot of history and actually ignored a number of data points that show that in the 18th century and 19th century, American states restricted guns a lot more than we usually assume today. If you entered a town in the American West carrying a gun, you may well have been kicked out. If you tried to carry a gun in the streets of a city when the Constitution was ratified, you may well have been arrested. But Thomas is not a real historian. He is an amateur. And so he deploys this kind of dilettante analysis to exclude every single fact that's not convenient for his conclusion and only focus on those states that had more liberal gun laws and use those to leverage against New York's current law, which, as you said, is a century old, to claim that it's an anomaly and cannot stand under the Second Amendment.
So can you talk now about what this means? We're talking about five other states who have similar laws to New York, and the irony of this coming on the very day that the Senate, which does not want to pass any gun control, at least the Republicans do not, in the Senate, did pass very limited gun control legislation.
Well, it feels like one step forward, two steps back to me. I think that the Senate bill is very good for what it does. It's important to increase scrutiny of gun buyers under 21 who are statistically far more likely to commit violent crime. It's good to increase incentives for red flag laws. But there is also a lot of evidence that shows that more permissive concealed carry regimes, like the one that the Supreme Court just forced on New York, lead to an increase in gun homicides and an increase in overall violence within a state. There is, meanwhile, essentially no evidence that these permissive concealed carry laws protect individuals from violence or help victims of crimes. You can seek out individual anecdotes in which someone used a gun to protect themselves, but if you look at the broader level, if you look at the state population, individuals are far more likely to be murdered with a concealed weapon for no good reason than they are to protect themselves with one. So while I think the Senate bill will certainly save lives, I think the Supreme Court's decision will cost lives. And it's especially sad because states like New York, Hawaii, Maryland are doing a lot of good in tackling gun violence. And this decision just withdraws from the public sphere, from the democratic debate, one of the single most important tools that a state previously had to reduce the rates of gun homicides within its borders.
Finally, Mark, before we go, I mean, gun control, lifting the gun ban and imposing an abortion ban, essentially, are the two big cases everyone's looking for. But there have been other rulings. Can you talk about the piece you wrote about in your piece headlined, Alito's attack on Miranda warnings is worse than it seems?
Yes. Yeah, so Justice Alito's opinion for the court in this decision held that receiving Miranda warnings, the right to remain silent, the right to have a lawyer, we've all seen it on TV and crime shows, that that right is not actually rooted in the Constitution and that it is a court-made right. And so when it is violated, victims have no redress. They cannot sue in court. They cannot seek some kind of remedy, even if they are wrongfully convicted on the basis of a Miranda violation. And his opinion contains language that suggests that the court may outright overrule the Miranda decision from 1965. If the court takes that step, it will usher in a new era of coerced and involuntary confessions, many of which are unreliable or outright false, and knock down one of the few remaining safeguards that protects criminal suspects from abusive and coercive tactics when they're taken into custody and interrogated.
Mark Joseph Stern, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior writer at Slate, and we'll link to the pieces that you write there. Next up, the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol reveals new details about Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election. Stay with us. standby.hacker. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol has revealed new details about President Donald Trump's efforts to pressure the Justice Department to help him stay in power after he lost the 2020 election. In the committee's fifth televised public hearing Thursday, former top Justice Department officials testified about how Trump urged the department to seize voting machines and declare the election results corrupt. Today, we bring you highlights. This is part of committee chair Congressmember Benny Thompson's opening statement.
Donald Trump didn't just want the Justice Department to investigate. He wanted the Justice Department to help legitimize his lies, to basically call the election corrupt, to appoint a special counsel to investigate alleged election fraud, to send a letter to six state legislatures urging them to consider altering the election results. And when these and other efforts fail, Donald Trump sought to replace Mr. Rosen, the acting attorney general, with a lawyer who he believed would inappropriately put the full weight of the Justice Department behind the effort to overturn the election. Let's think about what that means. Wherever you live in the United States, there's probably a local government executive, a mayor, or a county commissioner. There's also an official responsible for enforcing the laws, a district attorney, or a local prosecutor. Imagine if your mayor lost a re-election bid, but instead of conceding the race, they picked up the phone, called the district attorney, and said, "I want you to say this election was stolen. I want you to tell the Board of Elections not to certify the results." That's essentially what Donald Trump was trying to do with the election for president of the United States. It was a brazen attempt to use the Justice Department to advance the president's personal political agenda.
One of the former top DOJ officials who testified at Thursday's hearing was Trump's former acting deputy attorney general, Richard Donahue, questioned by one of the committee's two Republicans, Congressmember Adam Kinzinger. Donahue described a phone conversation with President Trump. This begins with a video clip of Republican lawmakers, including Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene, promoting Trump's big lie.
January 6th, I'm joining with the fighters in the Congress, and we are going to object to electors from states that didn't run clean elections. Democracy is left undefended if we accept the result of a stolen election without fighting with every bit of vigor we can muster.
The ultimate date of significance is January 6th. This is how the process works. The ultimate arbiter here, the ultimate check and balance, is the United States Congress. And when something is done in an unconstitutional fashion, which happened in several of these states, we have a duty to step forward and have this debate and have this vote on the 6th of January.
Today is the day American patriots start taking down names and kicking ass.
Mr. Donahue, on December 27th, you had a 90-minute conversation with the president where he raised false claim after false claim with you and Mr. Rosen. How did you respond to what you called a, quote, stream of allegations?
The December 27th conversation was, in my mind, an escalation of the earlier conversations. As the former acting AG indicated, there were a lot of communications that preceded that. As we got later in the month of December, the president's entreaties became more urgent. He became more adamant that we weren't doing our job. We need to step up and do our job. And he had this arsenal of allegations that he wanted to rely on. And so I felt in that conversation that it was incumbent on me to make it very clear to the president what our investigations had revealed, and that we had concluded, based on actual investigations, actual witness interviews, actual reviews of documents, that these allegations simply had no merit. And I wanted to try to cut through the noise, because it was clear to us that there were a lot of people whispering in his ear, feeding him these conspiracy theories and allegations. And I felt that being very blunt in that conversation might help make it clear to the president that these allegations were simply not true. And so as he went through them in what for me was a 90-minute conversation or so, and what for the former acting AG was a two-hour conversation, as the president went through them, I went piece by piece to say, no, that's false. That is not true. And to correct him really in a serial fashion as he moved from one theory to another.
Can you give me an example of one or two of those theories?
So one that was very clear at that point was the Antrim County, the ASOG report that I mentioned earlier. The Allied Security Operations Group released this report that's at 68% error rate. There was, in fact, in Antrim County, a hand recount. Had nothing to do with the department. The department did not request that. That was pursuant to litigation brought by other parties. But there was a hand recount. So they were able to compare the hand recount to what the machines had reported. And for the ballots that were actually counted by the machine, more than 15,000, there was one error, one ballot. And I did a quick calculation and came up with 0.0063% error rate, which is well within tolerance. And so I made it very clear to the president, because he was so fixated on the ASOG report in the December 15th conversation, that, in fact, our investigation revealed that the error rate was 0.0063%. So that, Mr. President's example, what people are telling you, that is not true, and that you cannot and should not be relying on. So that was one very explicit one, and I think you see that reflected in my notes. We went through a series of others. The truck driver who claimed to have moved an entire tractor trailer of ballots from New York to Pennsylvania, that was also incorrect. We did an investigation where the FBI interviewed witnesses at the front end and the back end of that trailer's transit from New York to Pennsylvania. We looked at loading manifests. We interviewed witnesses, including, of course, the driver, and we knew it wasn't true. Whether the driver believed or not was never clear to me, but it was just not true. So that was another one that I tried to educate the president on. There were a series of others, mostly in swing states. Of course, he wanted to talk a great deal about Georgia, the State Farm Arena video, which he believed, for various reasons, was, as he said it, fraud staring you right in the face.
Many of President Trump's efforts to push the Department of Justice to help him overturn the election involved a lower-level DOJ attorney named Jeffrey Clark, who Trump actually named attorney general for a brief period of time. On Wednesday, federal agents raided Clark's home. Witnesses were asked about Clark during Thursday's hearing of the House Select Committee. This clip begins with a video deposition recording of investigators questioning Trump's top campaign lawyer, Rudy Giuliani.
I don't remember ever recommending to anybody that Mr. Clark, meaning Jeffrey Clark at DOJ, be given election-related responsibilities.
You mean beyond the president?
Correct.
Well, beyond the president, I do recall saying to people that somebody should be put in charge of the Justice Department who isn't frightened of what's going to be done to their reputation. Because Judge Trump was filled with people like that.
Should put somebody that's not frightened of what's going to be done to their reputation. Mr. Donahue, when you told the president that you wouldn't pursue baseless claims of fraud, was it because you were worried about your reputation?
No, not at all.
Mr. Clark's name was also mentioned in the White House in late December and early January as described by a top aide to Mark Meadows, Cassidy Hutchinson.
Was it your understanding that Representative Kerry was pushing for a specific person to take over the department?
He wanted Mr. Clark, Mr. Jeff Clark, to take over the Department of Justice.
Mr. Rosen, after your call with President Trump on December 24th, you spoke with Mr. Clark on December 26th about his contact with the president. Can you tell us about that conversation?
Yes. Because I had been quizzical about why his name had come up, I called him, and I tried to explore if he would share if there was something I ought to know. And after some back and forth, he acknowledged that shortly before Christmas, he had gone to a meeting in the Oval Office with the president. That, of course, surprised me. And I asked him, how did that happen? And he was defensive. He said it had been unplanned, that he had been talking to someone he referred to as General Perry, but I believe as Congressman Perry, and that unbeknownst to him, he was asked to go to a meeting and he didn't know it, but it turned out it was at the Oval. He found himself at the Oval Office, and he was apologetic for that. And I said, well, you didn't tell me about it. It wasn't authorized, and you didn't even tell me after the fact. You know, this is not appropriate. But he was contrite and said it had been inadvertent and it would not happen again, and that if anyone asked him to go to such a meeting, he would notify Rich Donahue and me.
Is there a policy that governs who can have contact directly with the White House?
Yes. So across many administrations for a long period of time, there's a policy that, particularly with regard to criminal investigations, restricts at both the White House end and the Justice Department end those more sensitive issues to the highest ranks. So for criminal matters, the policy for a long time has been that only the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General from the DOJ side can have conversations about criminal matters with the White House, or the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General can authorize someone for a specific item with their permission, but the idea is to make sure that the top rung of the Justice Department knows about it and is in the thing to control it and make sure only appropriate things are done.
Mr. Engel, from your perspective, why is it important to have a policy like Mr. Rosen just discussed?
Well, it's critical that the Department of Justice conducts its criminal investigations free from either the reality or any appearance of political interference. And so people can get in trouble if people at the White House are speaking with people at the department. And that's why the purpose of these policies is to keep these communications as infrequent and at the highest levels as possible, just to make sure that people who are less careful about it, who don't really understand these implications, such as Mr. Clark, don't run afoul of those contact policies.
Thank you. So the Select Committee conducted an informal interview with the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, Pat Philbin, about their contact with Mr. Clark, though neither has yet agreed to sit for transcribed and videotaped interviews. But Pat Cipollone told the Select Committee that he intervened when he heard Mr. Clark was meeting with the president about legal matters without his knowledge, which was strictly against White House policy. Mr. Cipollone and Mr. Philbin, like Mr. Rosen, told Mr. Clark to stand down, and he didn't. On the same day, Acting Attorney General Rosen told Mr. Clark to stop talking to the White House. Representative Perry was urging Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to elevate Clark within the Department of Justice. You can now see on the screen behind me a series of texts between Representative Perry and Mr. Meadows. They show that Representative Perry requested that Mr. Clark be elevated within the department. Representative Perry tells Mr. Meadows on December 26th that, quote, Mark, just checking in as time continues to count down. 11 days to January 6th and 25 days to inauguration, we've got to get going. Representative Perry followed up and says, quote, Mark, you should call Jeff. I just got off the phone with him, and he explained to me why the principal deputy won't work, especially with the FBI. They will view it as not having the authority to enforce what needs to be done. Mr. Meadows responds with, I got it. I think I understand. Let me work on the deputy position. Representative Perry then texts, Roger, just sent you something on Signal. Just sent you an updated file. Did you call Jeff Clark?
Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger questioning Trump's top Department of Justice official, Steve Engel, the acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, and Richard Donahue. We'll be back with more of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack in 30 seconds. My Comfort Remains by Michael Brook and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with highlights from the fifth public hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol that revealed new details about former President Donald Trump's efforts to pressure the Justice Department to help him stay in power and subvert the 2020 election. This is Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger asking about the baseless conspiracy theory that an Italian defense contractor had hacked a satellite switching votes from Trump to Biden, which was embraced by senior Trump officials, including President Trump and Representative Scott Perry.
So the final email here included a completely baseless conspiracy theory that an Italian defense contractor uploaded software to a satellite that switched votes from Trump to Biden. The Select Committee investigation found that this wild, baseless conspiracy theory made it from the recesses of the internet to the highest echelons of our government. On December 31st, Mr. Meadows received this internet conspiracy theory from Representative Perry. On the screen now is the text that Representative Perry sent to Mr. Meadows, copying a YouTube link with the message, quote, "Why can't we just work with the Italian government?" The next day, the president's chief of staff sent the YouTube link to Mr. Rosen, who forwarded it to Mr. Donahue. Mr. Donahue, did you watch this video?
I did, Congressman.
How long was the video?
Approximately 20 minutes.
Let's just take a look at an excerpt of that video, if we may.
What's being said out of Rome, out of Italy, is that this was done in the U.S. Embassy. That there was a certain State Department guy whose name I don't know yet. I guess this is probably going to come out in Italy at some point. And he was the mastermind, not the mastermind, but the guy running the operation of changing the votes. And that he was doing this in conjunction with some support from MI6, the CIA, and this Leonardo group.
Mr. Donahue, what was your reaction when you watched that entire 20-minute video?
I emailed the acting attorney general, and I said pure insanity, which was my impression of the video, which was patently absurd.
Mr. Rosen, you were asked by Mr. Meadows to meet with Mr. Johnson, who is the person in that video. What was your reaction to that request?
So ordinarily, I'd get an email like this, and there was no phone call. It would just, you know, come over the transom. But this one, he called me, Mr. Meadows, and asked me to meet with Mr. Johnson. And I told him this whole thing about Italy had been debunked, and that should be the end of that, and I certainly wasn't going to meet with this person. And he initially seemed to accept that. He said, you know, well, why won't you meet with him? I said, because if he has real evidence, which this video doesn't show, he can walk into an FBI field office anywhere in the United States. There's 55 of them. And he said, okay. But then he called me back a few minutes later and complained and said, I didn't tell you, but this fellow Johnson is working with Rudy Giuliani, and Mr. Giuliani is really offended that you think they have to go to a FBI field office. That's insulting. So couldn't you just have the FBI or you meet with these guys? And by then I was somewhat agitated and told them that there was no way on earth that I was going to do that. I wasn't going to meet with Mr. Johnson. I certainly wasn't going to meet with Mr. Giuliani. I'd made that clear repeatedly, and said that's the end of that. You know, don't raise this with me again. And so, because Mr. Donahue and I had been exchanging our views about this, I think it was 7:13 on a Friday night of New Year's Day, I had run out of patience, and I sent the email that you're talking about where. I made pretty clear that I had no interest in doing anything further with this.
That's Trump's former acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, testifying at Thursday's hearing on the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The hearing also revealed senior Justice Department officials threatened to resign en masse if Trump had fired Rosen as attorney general, replaced him with Jeff Clark. This is Republican Congress member Adam Kinzinger questioning.
So as part of the Select Committee's investigation, we found out, well, Mr. Rosen, Mr. Donahue, and Mr. Engel were preparing for their meeting at the White House. Jeff Clark and the president were in constant communication beginning at 7 a.m. White House call logs obtained by the committee show that by 4:19 p.m. on January 3rd, the White House had already begun referring to Mr. Clark as the acting attorney general. As far as the White House was concerned, Mr. Clark was already at the top of the Justice Department. 2 hours later, DOJ leadership arrived at the White House. The Select Committee interviewed every person who was inside the room during this Sunday evening Oval Office meeting. Mr. Cipollone told the committee that he was, quote, unmistakably angry during the meeting, and that he, along with Eric Hirschman and Mr. Donahue, quote, forcefully challenged Mr. Clark to produce evidence of his election fraud theories. Mr. Rosen, can you describe how that meeting started?
Yes. So after some preliminaries, so Mr. Meadows had ushered us all in, and then he left. So Mr. Cipollone did some introductions and things. So after some preliminaries, the president turned to me, and he said, well, one thing we know is you, Rosen, you aren't going to do anything. You don't even agree with the claims of election fraud. And this other guy at least might do something. And then I said, well, Mr. President, you're right that I'm not going to allow the Justice Department to do anything to try to overturn the election. That's true. But the reason for that is because that's what's consistent with the facts and the law, and that's what's required under the Constitution. So that's the right answer and a good thing for the country, and therefore, I submit, it's the right thing for you, Mr. President. And that kicked off another 2 hours of discussion in which everyone in the room was in one way or another making different points, but supportive of my approach for the Justice Department and critical of Mr. Clark.
So at some point, Mr. Donahue comes in the room. Can you explain what led to him coming in the room?
I forgot about that. So initially, in part, I think, because he was underdressed, we had not yet told the president that he was going to come in. The White House had a list of who would be there. That did include Mr. Engel and the White House counsel and the deputy White House counsel, Mr. Hirschman. We went in, and then we told the president, maybe 10 minutes into the meeting or something, I forget how far in, that Mr. Donahue was outside, and he said, we'll bring him in. And then Mr. Donahue came in and joined the meeting.
So, Mr. Donahue, you enter that room. Can you set the scene for us and describe the tone you walked into?
Yes, but if I could just back up one moment, Congressman, because you put the pictures up on the screen of the AAGs. I just want to make clear, one of the AAGs who was not on the screen was John Demers. John was the National Security Division AAG. John was on the call, but I preface the call by saying, John, we need you to stay in place. National security is too important. We need to minimize a disruption. Whether you resign is entirely up to you, obviously, and we'll respect your decision either way, but I'm asking you, please stay in place. And he did, so I don't want to leave the impression that he was not willing to resign.
Great.
Because I think he was.
Thank you.
So with regard to entering the Oval Office, I was sitting in the hallway. An administrative assistant passed by. She asked me, are you supposed to be in this meeting with the president? I said, no, I'm simply here in case questions come up that other people don't have the answer to. And she walked away and then came back probably 30 seconds later and said, the president wants you in the meeting. I proceeded into the Oval Office. I took probably 2 or 3 steps in, and I stopped because I was, as the AG said, not exactly properly attired. I was wearing jeans and muddy boots and an Army T-shirt, and I never would arrive in the Oval Office this way. I said, Mr. President, I apologize. I'm sorry. I didn't know I was going to be here. And he said, no, just come in. And so I went in. I attempted to take a seat on one of the couches that are behind the chairs or right in front of the president's desk. And he said, oh, no, 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 you're going to be up here. And everyone kind of left. And they moved the chairs a little bit. Someone from the White House counsel's office picked up a spare chair and put it directly in front of the president, and I took that seat.
Was there discussion about Mr. Clark? Can you kind of enlighten some of what that discussion was?
Yes. So the conversation at this point had moved beyond the specific allegations, whether it was State Farm Arena or Antrim County or Pennsylvania or whatever. We had discussed those repeatedly, and that was backdrop to the conversation. But the conversation at this point was really about whether the president should remove Jeff Rosen and replace him with Jeff Clark. And everyone in the room, I think, understood that that meant that letter would go out. So that was the focus. It was about a 2.5-hour meeting after I entered. And so there were discussions about the pros and cons of doing that. Early on, the president said, what do I have to lose? And it was actually a good opening because I said, Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. And I began to explain to him what he had to lose. And what the country had to lose and what the department had to lose. And this was not in anyone's best interest. That conversation went on for some time. Everyone essentially chimed in with their own thoughts, all of which were consistent about how damaging this would be to the country, to the department, to the administration, to him personally. And at some point, the conversation turned to whether Jeff Clark was even qualified, competent, to run the Justice Department, which in my mind he clearly was not. And it was a heated conversation. I thought it was useful to point out to the president that Jeff Clark simply didn't have the skills, the ability, and the experience to run the department. And so I said, Mr. President, you're talking about putting a man in that seat who has never tried a criminal case, who's never conducted a criminal investigation. He's telling you that he's going to take charge of the department, 115,000 employees, including the entire FBI, and turn the place on a dime and conduct nationwide criminal investigations that will produce results in a matter of days. It's impossible. It's absurd. It's not going to happen, and it's going to fail. He has never been in front of a trial jury, a grand jury. He's never even been to Chris Wray's office. I said at one point, if you walked into Chris Wray's office, one, would you know how to get there? And two, if you got there, would you even know who you are? And do you really think that the FBI is going to suddenly start following your orders? It's not going to happen. He's not competent. And that's the point at which Mr. Clark tried to defend himself by saying, well, I've been involved in very significant civil and environmental litigation. I've argued many appeals and appellate courts and things of that nature. And then I pointed out that, yes, he was an environmental lawyer. And I didn't think that was appropriate background to be running the United States Justice Department.
Did anybody in there support Mr. Clark?
No one.
Mr. Rosen, it was you he was going to replace. So what was your view about the president's plan to appoint Mr. Clark?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, the issue really wasn't about me. It would have been fine, as I said, to have had Rich Donahue replace me. I would have said, great, I get 17 days vacation or something. But the issue was the use of the Justice Department. And it's just so important that the Justice Department adhere to the facts and the law. That's what it's there to do. And that's what our constitutional role was. And so if the Justice Department gets out of the role that it's supposed to play, that's really bad for our country. And I don't know of a simpler way to say that. And when you damage our fundamental institutions, it's not easy to repair them. So I thought this was a really important issue to try to make sure that the Justice Department was able to stay on the right course.
Mr. Donahue, did you eventually tell the president that mass resignations would occur if he installed Mr. Clark and what the consequences would be?
Yes. So this was in line with the president saying, what do I have to lose? Along those lines, he said, so suppose I do this. So suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. what would you do? And I said, Mr. President, I would resign immediately. I'm not working 1 minute for this guy, who I had just declared was completely incompetent. And so the president immediately turned to Mr. Engel, and he said, Steve, you wouldn't resign, would you? And he said, absolutely, I would, Mr. President. You leave me no choice. And then I said, and we're not the only ones. No one cares if we resign. If Steve and I go, that's fine. It doesn't matter. But I'm telling you what's going to happen. You're going to lose your entire department leadership. Every single AAG will walk out on you. Your entire department leadership will walk out within hours. And I don't know what happens after that. I don't know what the United States attorneys are going to do. We have U.S. attorneys in districts across the country. And my guess would be that many of them would have resigned. And that would then have led to resignations across the department in Washington. And I said, Mr. President, within 24, 48, 72 hours, you could have hundreds and hundreds of resignations of the leadership of your entire Justice Department because of your actions. What's that going to say about you?
That's Trump's former acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue. The FBI raided the home of Trump's pick for Attorney General Jeffrey Clark on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the January 6th committee revealed six members of Congress who supported Trump's coup attempts sought presidential pardons. Mo Brooks of Alabama, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louie Gohmert of Texas, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, and Andy Biggs of Arizona. This is Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger.
My colleagues and I up here also take an oath. Some of them failed to uphold theirs, and instead chose to spread the big lie. Days after the tragic events of January 6th, some of these same Republican members requested pardons in the waning days of the Trump administration. 5 days after the attack on the Capitol, Representative Mo Brooks sent the email on the screen now. As you see, he emailed the White House, quote, pursuant to a request from Matt Gaetz, requesting a pardon for Representative Gaetz, himself, and unnamed others. Witnesses told the Select Committee that the president considered offering pardons to a wide range of individuals connected to the president. Let's listen to some of that testimony.
And was Representative Gaetz requesting a pardon?
Believe so. The general tone was, we may get prosecuted because we were defensive of, you know, the president's positions on these things. The pardon that he was discussing, requesting, was as broad as you could describe from the beginning. I remember he's from the beginning of time up until today, for any and all things. He mentioned Nixon, and I said Nixon's pardon was never nearly that broad.
And are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons?
Mr. Gaetz and Mr. Brooks, I know, both advocated for there to be a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting and a handful of other members that weren't at the December 21st meeting as the preemptive pardons. Mr. Gaetz was personally pushing for a pardon, and he was doing so since early December. I'm not sure why. Mr. Gaetz had reached out to me to ask if he could have a meeting with Mr. Meadows about receiving a presidential pardon.
Did they all contact you?
Not all of them, but several of them did.
So you mentioned Mr. Gaetz, Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Gaetz did. Mr. Jordan talked about congressional pardons, but he never asked me for one. It was more for an update on whether the White House is going to pardon members of Congress. Mr. Gohmert asked for one as well.
That's Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, in her videotaped deposition. Oh, and before her, senior White House legal advisor Eric Hirschman. To see Thursday's full hearing, go to democracynow.org, as well as all five of the hearings in full. The public hearings of the January 6th committee will resume in mid-July. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Karen Renucci and a happy sixth birthday to Ava Crosby Wallach. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.